Welcome to this, the fifth in our series, The Theology of Law, a very short introduction. In this series of podcasts, we're looking at eight biblical floodlights, which will help us to understand the place of law within God's purposes for humankind. We've already looked at the doctrines of creation, the fall, common grace and providence, and the law of Moses. Now, in this fifth episode, we start thinking about what Israel's history tells us about how God sees law and its relationship to justice. This is the first of two episodes which will look at this fifth floodlight. In this episode, we're going to look at the history of Israel's kings, while in the next episode, we will look at the witness of Israel's prophets. This episode falls into five parts: God as the just king, the change in Israel's political arrangements from judges to kings, Solomon, kingship after Solomon, and Josiah. God as the just king. Ancient Near Eastern kings claimed to be gods. The Egyptian pharaohs did so. The Assyrian and Babylonian rulers did so. Even into New Testament times, Greek and Roman rulers did so. In contrast, the Old Testament resonates with the declaration, Yahweh Melech, the Lord is king. Psalm 10 verse 16 says, the Lord is king forever and ever. Psalm 24 verse 8, who is the king of glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Psalm 29 verse 10, the Lord sits enthroned over the throne. The Lord is enthroned as king forever. And so on and so on. Because God is king, an urgent question throughout the Hebrew scriptures is this: what kind of king is Israel's God? Is Yahweh a tyrant who treats his people like slaves, as Pharaoh treated the Israelites? Or is Yahweh a just God who wants the best for his people? And so we find Job asking, is God just despite what is happening to me personally? The sage of Ecclesiastes asking, is there justice under the sun? And the books of Kings and Chronicles constantly raising the question, is God just despite what is happening in Israel's history? The emphatic, though not uncomplicated answer that the Old Testament gives is that God is a just king. Psalm 145 verse 17 affirms, the Lord is righteous in all his ways and loving towards all he has made. As Nicholas Sagovsky explains, the Hebrew scriptures give us a history of God's justice, that is, of God's just dealings with the world and the people he has brought into being. The Old Testament continually questions and then reaffirms that God is a just king. God is a just king who has rescued God's people from slavery in Egypt and who has given them just laws. God is a just king who has been with God's people, sending them judges to rescue them from oppression. God is a just king who has authorized kings to lead God's people. And God is a just king who has acted justly in allowing God's people to be taken into exile in Babylon because of their sins. The biblical understanding of justice which underlies this is justice as a relational concept. People are righteous when they meet the claims which others have on them by virtue of their particular relationships. Thus, the king is righteous when he fulfills his responsibilities as king towards his people. The servant is righteous when he obeys his master. The Bible describes the relationship between God and God's people as a covenant. Israel's God is not a tyrant. God has given Israel a law and has bound himself through a covenant with God's people to act faithfully and for their good. The Old Testament witnesses that God's people have failed to act justly towards God. They've disobeyed God's commands. They have exploited, oppressed, and deceived one another. The exile is presented as God's just judgment on a people who'd sought to claim the blessings of being in a covenant relationship with God without being faithful to their responsibilities under that covenant. From Judges to Kings. One of the many puzzling things about the book of Judges is that many of the activities of the judges within it do not look all that judicial. Think, for example, of Ehud, the left-hander who plunged his sword into the belly of a fat king, or Samson with his erratic relationships with the Philistines and their women. There is clearly more to being a judge in the biblical sense than simply sitting behind a desk deciding cases. The Hebrew word for judge, shapat, covers both government and legal justice and is probably best rendered rule. Justice is about action which delivers people from injustice and oppression. In fact, the only judge who does what we would recognize as judging in the book of Judges is Deborah, who Judges chapter 4 verse 5 tells us held court and decided disputes. But it's appropriate to describe the other judges using the term shapat, because in the Old Testament there is a close connection between justice and deliverance. By giving judgment for the righteous claimant, the judge is seen as delivering her from the continued injustice of being deprived of her rights by the unrighteous defendant. In the contrary case, by giving judgment for the righteous defendant, the judge is seen as delivering him from the unjust accusation brought by the unrighteous claimant. In particular, therefore, as Psalm 72 verse 4 says, the just judge would defend the afflicted, protect the children of the needy, and crush the oppressor. Now, the activities of the judges were ad hoc. Israel lacked a stable, centralized authority. Judges chapter 17 verse 6 and chapter 21 verse 25 both say, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. The book of Judges shows us that laws do not work unless there are institutions to enforce them. And so the Israelites called for a king. The first king, Saul, descended into mental illness. The second king, David, delivered Israel from the oppression of the Philistines. And once his power was established, stole Bathsheba from his commander Uriah and then arranged for Uriah to be killed. Now, what is already striking about those stories is how Israel's prophets critiqued and challenged its kings. Far from being treated as gods, we are shown how kings are all too human, fallible, and frail. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 14 to 20 sets out a list of guidelines for kingship. It says, the king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself, or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law taken from that of the Levitical priests. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites and turn from the law to the right or to the left. There are two main concerns in this passage. One is that the king should not surround himself with too much power or too much luxury. The other is that the king should follow carefully all the words of the law and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites. Here we find the central idea of the rule of law. Israel's kings were accountable and answerable to the law. They were not above the law. After the wars of his father David, Solomon, whose name comes from Shalom, was meant to embody and achieve Shalom for his people. When Solomon was given a choice of a gift from God, God was pleased that Solomon asked for wisdom. But what 1 Kings chapter 3 verse 9 actually records him as asking for was a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. But tragically, the description of Solomon's reign in 1 Kings chapter 9 to 11 can be seen as an ironic commentary on how the one who was supposed to bring about the fullness of Shalom in fact led Israel into a situation of injustice, forced labor, and tyrannical excess. Solomon ended up with enormous wealth and military power and large numbers of wives, but failed to keep God's covenant and God's decrees. The message from Solomon's reign is, do not put your faith in strong leaders, they will disappoint you. Power needs to be kept accountable if it is to be exercised responsibly. And so we come to kingship after Solomon. The kingdom was divided in two as a result of a rebellion against the reign of Solomon's son Rehoboam. In the book of Kings, the rulers are assessed in terms of their faithfulness to the Lord and for the extent to which they led their people towards or away from faith in the true God. In the northern kingdom, the picture was invariably bleak. In the southern kingdom, the record was more mixed. Judged according to whether they did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and whether they did so to the same extent as their father David has done, there were 12 bad kings and one bad queen, 4 kings who were good but not as good as David, and 4 who are recorded as good, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Hezekiah, and Josiah. Before looking at what made Josiah such a great king, I want to draw your attention to just one story from the book of Kings. In 1 Kings chapter 21, we find the story of Naboth's vineyard. Ahab, king of Israel, had married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. In this mixed marriage, Jezebel worshipped Baal, and Ahab was supposed to worship Yahweh. The two had very different cultural understandings of kingship. The name of Jezebel's father, Ethbaal, tells us that she came from a culture in which the king was a god, free to do whatever he liked. Abraham understood that as king, he was answerable to the law of Moses. In 1 Kings chapter 21, Ahab longs to own a vineyard close to his palace, so he approaches its owner, Naboth. Naboth replies, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my ancestors." To grasp what is at stake in this particular transaction, we need to see things from Naboth's perspective. Naboth's family had been given the land as an inheritance when the Israelites had taken possession of the land of Canaan. This piece of land had been handed down through the generations and would be handed on by Naboth to his children, his grandchildren, and so on. Naboth knew that once the king bought the land, it would be lost to his family forever. He would be enriching himself at the expense of future generations. So Naboth refused to sell the vineyard to King Ahab. Ahab goes home and sulks. When he tells Jezebel why he's grumpy, she replies, "Is this how you act as king over Israel? Cheer up, I'll get you the vineyard of Naboth." In Jezebel's worldview, the king could do what he liked. In this story, we see the difference that the Israelite view of kingship makes to that of the world around. In the surrounding nations, the king was above the law and could do whatever he liked. In Israel, Yahweh was king and its rulers were answerable to God's law. God sent the prophet Elijah to denounce Ahab for killing Naboth and seizing his land in defiance of the law of Moses. Ahab belatedly acknowledged that what he had done was evil and repented, tearing his clothes, putting on sackcloth and fasting. In doing so, he conceded at last that he was accountable to God and to God's laws. Accountability to God was a great lesson which Josiah learned when he was a boy. Josiah became king when he was just 8 years old and reigned for 31 years. He's praised in 2 Kings chapter 22, verse 2, because he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. He undertook a program of repairs to the temple. He led the people in a national revival of their commitment to God. He conducted major reforms to the worship of God and organized one of the biggest Passover celebrations ever seen. He was a great religious reformer, a man whose zeal for God was almost unparalleled. 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 25 gives Josiah the highest praise. It says, "Neither before nor after Josiah was there a king like him who turned to the Lord as he did, with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his strength, in accordance with all the law of Moses." Josiah is clearly commended as a man who was wholehearted for God, who tried his hardest to fulfill the first great commandment. And the effect of Josiah's reign was remarkable. 2 Kings chapter 34, verse 33 tells us that as long as he lived, the people did not fail to follow the Lord, the God of their fathers. After his death, Jeremiah condemned Josiah's sons, Shallum and Jehoiakim. In Jeremiah chapter 22, he wrote, "Woe to him who builds his palace by unrighteousness, his upper rooms by injustice, making his countrymen work for nothing, not paying them for their labor. Does it make you a king to have more and more cedar? Did not your father have food and drink?" But Jeremiah's comparison of Josiah's son with their father does not go quite the way we would expect. Having read about Josiah's major religious achievements, we'd expect Jeremiah to say, "You're obsessed with cedar, your father was devoted to God. Your gods are your material possessions. Your father loves things of eternal value." But Jeremiah does not say this. Instead, he says, "He did what was right and just, so all went well with him. He defended the cause of the poor and the needy, and so all went well. Is that not what it means to know me, declares the Lord? For your eyes and your heart are set only on dishonest gain, on shedding innocent blood, and on oppression and extortion." It is absolutely stunning to find God unequivocally affirming that you cannot obey the first great commandment without also obeying the second. The way that you demonstrate that you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength is by loving your neighbor as yourself. And this message comes, as always in the Old Testament, with a particular emphasis on the vulnerable in society. Jeremiah declares in Jeremiah chapter 5, verses 28 and 29, that God has condemned Josiah's sons because their evil deeds have no limit. They do not plead the case of the fatherless to win it. They do not defend the rights of the poor. Should I not punish them for this, declares the Lord? Should I not avenge myself on a nation such as this? God's instructions to kings in Jeremiah chapter 21, verse 12 is this. This is what the Lord says. Administer justice every morning. Rescue from the hand of his oppressor the one who has been robbed, or my wrath will break out and burn like fire because of the evil you have done. burn with no one to quench it. So what lessons can we learn from the history of kingship in Israel? Here are five key points to take away. The Lord is a God of justice. The giving of the law was part of God's good gifts to Israel. Despite having the law, Israel did not act justly. Having centralized mechanisms of law enforcement in the shape of kings did not make Israel just. Therefore, law is not the complete solution to the problems of injustice. Join me in our next episode when we'll be looking at what God said through the prophets about law and justice.